Hello there and welcome. Today is Wednesday, February 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, seven Earth-sized worlds found orbiting a star.
The discovery gives us a hint that finding a second Earth is not just a matter of if, but when.
Voter discontent rages on in town halls across the U.S. Jews and Muslims, though, come together in solidarity against hate. Also ahead, we've got some entertainment news. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump is dismissing protests that have broken out against his plan to dismantle national health care reforms that marked former President Barack Obama's signature legislative achievement. The White House said Wednesday that Trump would propose a new health care plan to replace the Affordable Care Act, popularly known as Obamacare, in, quote, the next couple of weeks. During the current week-long congressional recess, numerous Republican lawmakers have been facing angry voters at town hall gatherings in their home state districts, this one directed at Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
The last I heard, these coal jobs are not coming back, and now these people don't have the insurance they need because they're poor. And they work those coal mines, and they're sick. The veterans are sick. The veterans are broken down. They're not getting what they need. If you can answer any of that, I'll sit down and shut up like Elizabeth Warren.
Some, as Trump said, have organized efforts against Republican lawmakers looking to repeal the law. Others, though, at the town halls appear to be individual voters saying they'll lose their insurance and be unable to pay their medical bills for severe health problems.
I have to have coverage in order to make sure that I don't die. There are people who have cancer that have that coverage, that have to have that coverage to make sure that they don't die. And you want to take away this coverage and have nothing to replace it with.
Well, national polls show the law is now more popular than when it was when its existence was not seriously threatened. White House spokesman Sean Spicer acknowledged that some of the protesters are upset, but said that others are part of manufactured protests. Well, the Trump administration moved Wednesday to revoke U.S. guidelines that let transgender students use bathrooms and locker rooms matching their chosen gender identity rather than the gender listed for them at birth. White House spokesman Sean Spicer said in a statement of guidance on the controversial issue, it would reverse a directive issued last year by former President Barack Obama.
They've been reviewing the guidance that was signed, the basis by which it was put through, and I think there have been several areas of concern, both legal and procedural, that they have been discussing.
Spicer said it was not a priority for President Trump to rescind the Obama order, but that the new administration was forced to decide if it would defend it in a pending court case and opted not to. He said the issue of transgender rights in bathrooms in public schools and other buildings is best left for the 50 U.S. state governments to decide.
I've made this clear, and the president's made it clear throughout the campaign, that he is a firm believer in states' rights and that certain issues like this are not best dealt with at the federal level.
Well, under Obama, thousands of public schools throughout the country were required to grant transgender students access to bathrooms of their choosing, even if it was not the same gender as on the students' school records. Under the new guidance, Trump officials said anti-bullying safeguards are being kept in place to protect transgender students from taunts of classmates at their schools. The Anti-Defamation League Monday reported at least 10 Jewish community centers in multiple states had received bombing threats, and a fourth string of such threats since the beginning of the year. A fundraising campaign organized by Muslim Americans has raised tens of thousands of dollars to help repair vandalism to as many as 200 headstones at a Jewish cemetery in the central U.S. state of Missouri. Vice President Mike Pence visited that cemetery on Wednesday.
Speaking just yesterday, President Trump called this a horrible and painful act, and so it was. That, along with other recent threats to Jewish community centers around the country, he declared it all a sad reminder of the work that still must be done to root out hate and prejudice and evil. We condemn this vile act of vandalism and those who perpetrate it in the strongest possible terms.
Well, donations surpassed $20,000 in just a few hours by these Muslim Americans, and by early Wednesday, the total stood at more than 55,000. Now, since the president's now blocked temporary travel ban from seven predominantly Muslim countries, there's been a show of solidarity between members of the Jewish and Muslim faiths. Joining me now to talk more about this is Rabbi Reuven Firestone, a professor at the Hebrew Union College at the Jewish Institute of Religion in Los Angeles. Thanks for being with us. So, Jews and Muslims really do seem unlikely friends.
There's reason for that. Jews and Muslims have a lot in common, demographically even. Jews and Muslims in America fit very similar patterns of professionalism and as a minority. And one of their biggest aspects of commonality is the fact that they're not Christians and they live in a Christian world. So Jews and Muslims in America are non-Christian communities that are living in a country that is seen by Jews and Muslims. And if you were a non-Christian as a Hindu or a Baha'i, you would see it as well, is a profoundly Christian country. There are a lot of Christians who wouldn't agree, but certainly culturally it's very Christian. And so it puts these groups sort of out of the mainstream, and they feel a certain level of alienation.
I was at one of the demonstrations a couple of weeks ago at the White House here in Washington, and I saw signs at these protests that said things like "Never Again," referencing the Holocaust, and they were standing alongside Muslims. So it certainly seems to be an interesting evolution that's taking place in the country.
Yeah, because Jews and Muslims in America have a tremendous amount in common, social issues and political issues, mostly because they're the odd person out, if you will, from a larger culture. On the other hand, Jews have integrated for a longer period of time than Muslims. They're very well established and still are not completely comfortable in this culture. And they can relate on a very visceral level, particularly because of tragedies of Jewish history, to the kind of horrible situation that Muslims are facing in the United States and in Europe and actually in the Muslim world, too. There's a natural empathy there.
We have seen a rash of hate crimes, a rise in hate crimes since the election. And we've also seen things like, you know, swastikas painted on buildings. We've seen Nazi salutes, Confederate flags, and then we did see a mosque torched. And I thought it was remarkable that a synagogue offered to provide worshippers of that mosque to use their synagogue.
Yeah, this is actually a grassroots response. First of all, the rise in anti-Semitism in America is really frightening. The head of the ADL, Jonathan Greenblatt, announced really in November, toward the end of the election campaign, and they have tools to be able to test this. The level of anti-Semitism is worse than it's ever been any time since the 1930s when Nazis were in power in Germany. So that's a serious statement, and it's made by a serious man who's running a serious organization. So that's something to think about. But the Jewish response to Islamophobic incident and acts of violence against Muslims is very much visceral, I think, and it's all over. I was just sort of scanning the news. In New Jersey, there are many synagogues that are adopting refugee families from Syria. Muslim families, knowing that they're Muslim families. There are synagogues in Canada that are doing the same. And in response to the horrific massacre of Muslims in Quebec City, there's a synagogue in Toronto organized a big Ring of Peace project in which Jews surround mosques during the midday prayers as a show of solidarity and support. It doesn't go only in that direction, by the way. I should mention that last month I was giving a talk at the Peninsula Jewish Community Center near San Francisco, and it was one of more than 16 Jewish centers that were targets of bomb threats, and they had to be evacuated. And I was giving a talk about Jewish-Muslim relations, and a person asked the question, well, Professor Firestone, I know that you are really interested in Islam and in helping Muslims around the world, but are there any Muslims who reach out to Jews? And before I could respond, the assistant executive director of the community center piped up and said, "You have no idea. We received so many phone calls from Muslims in the area offering support and asking what they can do to help us after those bomb threats. It was a very gratifying experience," she said. So that kind of sentiment goes in both directions.
And you mentioned Jonathan Greenblatt. He also said that if the president were to have some sort of Muslim registry, that he, as a Jew, would register. And I think I have heard that from others as well.
Actually, my congregation in Los Angeles, which has probably a few thousand members, it's a very significant congregation, basically pledged that they would all register as Muslims if there was a Muslim registry in the U.S. That's a significant statement. My Muslim colleagues and virtually everybody I know in this country who's Muslim says over and over again, quietly and sometimes even publicly, that the U.S. is the best place to be a Muslim in the world today. And they really mean it, because they have more freedom and more support for learning about Islam and expressing their own understanding of Islam in a way that is uninhibited than anywhere else in the world. And that's a pretty extraordinary statement.
Are they at all, though, concerned that that could change with this new administration?
I'm still hearing that statement, but I know there's a lot of concern. People are fearful.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective, Reuven Firestone, with the Hebrew Union College at the Jewish Institute of Religion in Los Angeles. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. diplomat, security chief, to meet with the Mexican leader. Donald Trump to address the country's largest gathering of conservatives. Google ventures into ride-sharing service. The U.S. charges California auctioneer with smuggling endangered rhino horn. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. An organization that fights pornography and human trafficking is out with its fifth annual list that it calls its Dirty Dozen. It's a list companies are hoping not to be on. Joining me for more on this is Dawn Hawkins, Vice President of the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. Tell us more about what this list is and why you've compiled it.
You know, America is awash in a sexual exploitation crisis. We've got sexual violence, sex trafficking, prostitution, child exploitation, pornography, incest, all of these things. And we found that major corporations, major entities, mainstream groups are helping to contribute to that problem, and they're facilitating this exploitation, many of them profiting from it. So we came up with this project, the Dirty Dozen List, to name major facilitators of sexual exploitation in America.
Do you have repeats on the list?
Many of the targets on the Dirty Dozen List are the same from year to year. This year we have four new targets. For example, we removed Verizon this year and moved them to the watch list. We met with the CEO of Verizon to share our concerns about how they are facilitating sexual exploitation, profiting from it. And then they responded that they were going to take one small step, the beginning of this year, they have developed this opt-in system for all new customers of their Fios TV. So basically, new customers have to ask and request for access to hardcore pornography through their system, which means that families and parents, children aren't going to be exposed to it unless they really want it. So this is a good step forward. We remove them from the list, but they're on the watch list because they still are profiting from exploitation in many ways.
Who are on the list this time around?
Amnesty International is one that many tend to be surprised about.
Wow.
I know.
That is surprising.
Amnesty does a lot of good work in a lot of areas, but they're wrong in one really important area, and that is their policy on prostitution. Just recently, they have adopted this policy calling for the decriminalization of prostitution around the world, which essentially allows pimps and traffickers and sex buyers to get away with buying and selling women and children for sex. This is an incredible problem. We have seen that in areas, countries, and states where prostitution has been decriminalized, that sex trafficking goes up, the demand for it, and the violence that is suffered by these prostituted persons increases tremendously.
Who else is on the list?
One that I think is the biggest scandal that the Dirty Dozen list has covered is that of EBSCO Information Services. EBSCOhost is a database, an online database that provides resources to so many entities, including, though, K-12 schools. almost all public and private schools subscribe to these services. EBSCO has marketed their products as being curriculum appropriate and designed specifically for elementary, middle school, and high schools. But what we found within all of the products they market to these schools is that it's riddled with hardcore pornography links, with softcore porn, with a lot of articles giving advice for these young kids to engage in risky sexual behaviors. I didn't believe it when I first heard that this was happening. But as I started to look further and do my own research, I found this in schools across the United States and Canada. One thing that's so amazing is EBSCO called us yesterday when they found out that they are going to be named today on the Dirty Dozen list. And they asked us not to name them and said that they wanted to open a line of communication and they want to fix this problem. And I think that they're very sincere. They talked about how they're developing some new technology filters and algorithms to help fix this problem. But, you know, it's not enough. We need to call on these entities to be responsible and to stop allowing for sexual exploitation to come through. And so, you know, especially because EBSCO caters to these kids, and they're exposing them to things like public sex. This is what the articles are telling like seventh graders to do. This is very problematic.
And can you briefly run through the other names?
Sure. We have the American Library Association. A lot of people are surprised about that one.
Yeah.
Again, it's kind of like Amnesty. They do so much good, but they are wrong in a huge area, and that is that they mislead libraries around the country into thinking that they are not allowed to filter their computers. And as a result, we're seeing that patrons who are frequenting libraries are watching pornography. They're acting out with the librarians are complaining about the dangers that they're facing. Other patrons are being stalked and harassed after patrons view pornography on the library computers. And the reality is that our federal government provides special funding to libraries to filter. And the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld laws mandating that libraries filter, but yet the ALA disseminates incorrect and misleading information to libraries, scaring them away from making the library really a safe place for our kids and families. You know, let me tell you, we've had a lot of success with the Dirty Dozen list.
Yeah, it sounds like it's making a difference.
It is making a difference. For example, we got the Department of Defense. Remember a couple years ago when sexual assault was just through the roof in our nation's military? I mean, it's still definitely a big problem. We pointed out, for example, that
all right, well, it looks like we lost the connection, so we'll thank her very much, Dawn Hawkins, Vice President of the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. Well, for the first time, astronomers have discovered seven Earth-sized planets orbiting a nearby star, and these new worlds could hold life. NASA and the Belgian-led research team announced the news on Wednesday. Scientist Thomas Zurbuchen.
What we really have in this story is a major step forward towards answering one of these very questions that are at the heart of so many of our philosophers of what we're thinking about when we're by ourselves, and that basically is, are we alone out there?
Well, Zurbuchen says the discovery gives the hint that finding a second Earth is not just a matter of if, but when. This cluster of planets is 40 light years away in the constellation Aquarius. They circle tightly around a dim dwarf star. Three planets are in the so-called habitable zone, where water and possibly life might exist.
The discovery gives us a hint that finding a second Earth is not just a matter of if, but when.
Scientists say they need to study the atmospheres before determining whether these planets could support some form of life. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now with Hollywood news, and for that, we're joined by Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. So, for those who don't know the name David Cassidy, he's an American pop singer who was a huge teen idol in the 1970s, wildly popular also on the TV show The Partridge Family. He's been in the news a lot in the past year for being possibly drunk and for erratic behavior, but Nicole, it sounds like that's not really what's been happening at all.
Yeah, so this is kind of a sad story. Earlier this month, David Cassidy came out and told fans that he was going to retire. He was going to start slowing down, and his concerts on February 18th were going to be his last concerts. He performed in California, and fans at that show reported that he appeared drunk and confused, and he did struggle with substance abuse in his earlier years. So he, of course, people went right to that saying, oh, he was drunk and whatnot. And he came forward and said, no, I wasn't drunk. I actually have been diagnosed with dementia, and this diagnosis happened in 2015. And he has always been open. His mother also was diagnosed with dementia, as well as his grandmother. So it's kind of a tough time for him. And now, as before, when he announced his retirement, it was to just take it easy and enjoy his life, but now it's to focus on his health. So it's kind of a sad time for him. I know a lot of his fans are sending thoughts and prayers. His former Partridge Family co-star Danny Bonaducci also tweeted in support and asked fans to kind of rally around him at this time. So everybody's wishing him the best.
For sure. That's a tough one. And it seems to definitely be something that is inherited. Well, let's turn to a happier story. We know that Hoda Kotb has revealed the inspiration for her new baby girl.
Yes, she and her boyfriend Joel Schiffman have adopted a new baby girl who they named Haley Choi. And Hoda on Tuesday, when she announced the big news, revealed that she came up with the inspiration from Haley's comet. She said she pictured her little girl just sailing through the sky, which is very sweet. And the name Joy, the middle name, comes from the feeling that she and Joel feel for the baby. So that's a very exciting time for them. I know she's been posting a lot of pictures on social media. So I'm very, very happy for them and their new little family.
All right. Well, we appreciate your coming on and talking about it. Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella, thanks for being with us. When the Oscars are handed out Sunday in Hollywood, the Best Original Song category has two from the movie La La Land competing against each other. As VOA's David Byrd reports, the category also features a song composed by Emmy, Tony, and Grammy winner Lin-Manuel Miranda and a poignant tribute penned by Sting.
City of stars, are you shining just for me? City of stars, there's so much that I can't see.
La La Land is up for a total of 14 Academy Awards on Sunday. The film has two chances of taking home the Best Original Song Award for City of Stars, sung by Ryan Gosling, and Emma Stone's showpiece, Audition, The Fools Who Dream.
Here's to the hearts that ache. Here's to the mess we make.
La La Land director Damien Chazelle, who is nominated for Best Director and Best Original Screenplay, says he always thought the movie would resonate with audiences.
It was a hard movie to get financed, you know, and there was always that question of who is the audience for it, but I've always thought that musicals at their heart are a populist medium and that it's about being in a theater with a big crowd, seeing people break in a song. I think that's what it's all about.
It's the wind in my sail on the sea, she's behind me.
Grammy, Tony, and Emmy Award winner Lin-Manuel Miranda, whose musical Hamilton dominated last year's Tony Awards, is up for his song How Far I'll Go from the Disney animated film Moana. Miranda says the song hits on universal themes.
We all have that one thing. It's not necessarily a call to the sea. It's not necessarily I want to write songs, but it is, there's a voice inside all of us, and it talks to us whether we like it or not. And that's what that song's about. It's about being 16 and the distance and between you and your dreams seeming impossible, but listening to that voice anyway.
If he wins, Miranda will have an EGOT, an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony.
Would keep my place on the empty chair, and somehow I'll be there, and somehow I'll be there.
Sting and J. Ralph are nominated for The Empty Chair from the documentary Jim, the James Foley Story. Foley, a photojournalist reporting on the Syrian civil war, was captured in 2012 and later beheaded by the Islamic State group in 2014. J. Ralph says that Sting came up with the song while sitting at his Thanksgiving dinner after seeing the film.
And he looked around the kitchen table and had this concept, if there was an empty chair, what would he, do for his family, if someone was missing, and he would leave an empty chair. And that was his way in, and in less than 24 hours, he sent back the finished lyrics. And I said to him, you got to try to at least make this look hard, man. And he laughed. He said, well, when you find a way in, it's very easy.
The fifth nominee for Best Original Song is Can't Stop the Feeling from another animated film, Trolls. The hugely popular tune was written by Justin Timberlake, Max Martin, and Carl Johan Schuster, and performed by Timberlake and the film cast members, including Anna Kendrick. The Oscars will be handed out Sunday night in Hollywood. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thanks for being with us. This is International Edition on VOA.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Donald Trump is taking aim at transnational criminal organizations and international trafficking. In a recent executive order, President Trump called for the enforcement and strengthening of U.S. federal law to thwart transnational criminal organizations and their subsidiaries, including criminal gangs, cartels, racketeering organizations, and other groups engaged in illicit activities that present a threat to public safety and national security. The activities include the illegal smuggling and trafficking of humans, drugs, or other substances, wildlife, and weapons, corruption, cybercrime, fraud, financial crimes, and intellectual property theft, as well as the illegal concealment or transfer of proceeds derived from these crimes. The order directs federal law enforcement agencies to give high priority to the identification, disruption, and dismantling of the transnational organizations engaging in such illicit activities, including through investigation, apprehension, and prosecution of members of these organizations, their extradition to face justice in the United States, and, where appropriate and lawful, the swift removal from the United States of individuals who are members of such organizations. The order also calls for enhanced cooperation with foreign counterparts working in the same area, as well as the development of strategies to maximize coordination among all U.S. federal agencies to counter such crimes within and beyond the United States. Transnational criminal organizations, the order states, are drivers of crime, corruption, violence, and misery. In particular, the trafficking by cartels of controlled substances has triggered a resurgence in deadly drug abuse and a corresponding rise in violent crime related to drugs. Likewise, the trafficking and smuggling of human beings by transnational criminal groups risk creating a humanitarian crisis. These crimes, along with many others, are enriching and empowering these organizations to the detriment of the American people. With this order, U.S. federal agencies, under the particular guidance of the Secretary of State, the Attorney General and the Secretary of Homeland Security, in compliance with all laws, are charged to develop strategies, utilize resources, and work together toward an essential goal. A comprehensive and decisive approach is required to dismantle these organized syndicates, the order states, and restore safety for the American people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.